It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Plastics, they are used on the farm, and we look at how they leach into the soil, what can be done to reduce the plastic pollution on Wisconsin's agricultural lands. A United Nations report from its science division says soil is under threat on multiple fronts, but there is only limited research on the impacts of plastics in soil and the potential uptake of microplastics by crops. Join in on plastics in farming, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Melissa Kono is here, an associate professor at UW-Madison in the Division of Extension. She's the community development educator for Clark and Trempealeau counties with UW Extension. Melissa, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, we'll start with how do farmers typically use plastic on farms?
Yeah, the use of agricultural plastics has really revolutionized the way that farmers can feed animals and store crops. And if you think of those hay bales wrapped in white plastic, they look like giant marshmallows out in the field. Or if you see a bunker that has that white and black plastic, that's agricultural plastics. And what that does for silage piles is it helps with the anaerobic process to properly ferment that feed. It can also offer protection from the elements, from animals, and it makes that food source closer to the livestock, or to keep those hay bales in the field, makes it easier for farmers. It's also safer than a traditional silo for farm safety. So it has really changed the way that food stock can be stored for animals.
What about these plastic sheets that you sometimes see spread over the soil that serve as like a plastic mulch, like suppressing weeds and, increasing the fertilizer uptake? What are some of the pros and cons of plastic covering soil?
Yeah, so that plastic mulch film is used a lot, especially when growing produce crops. They use it a lot in California on the West Coast, actually, for a lot of the food that we eat, fruits and, even flowers, vegetables, other things like that. And it just, again, as you said, it helps with preventing weeds, and it decreases the use of herbicide because we can use the mulch instead as that barrier.
But is that plastic leaching into the soil, or do scientists know what are the implications when you use plastic mulch?
Yeah, I have a colleague that I work with at the University of Washington, and she has done a lot of work on using biodegradable plastics, especially with fruit growers, strawberry, raspberry, blueberry growers out in Washington State. And one of the things they looked at is biodegradable plastics. But the thing with plastic is, it never really goes away. It just gets smaller. There has been some mixed results about how that ends up in the soil, depending on the usage, of course.
And speaking of biodegradable, there have been some recent advancements on plastic-coated seeds to create coatings that would replace that plastic film that protects the seed. And, farmers using these biodegradable films, is that going on in Wisconsin?
That is not something that's in my area of research, so I'm not sure on that.
Okay. I'm going to reintroduce you here for a moment. Talking about agricultural plastics and recycling with Melissa Kono, coordinates ag recycling in our state, also the community development educator for Clark and Trempealeau counties with UW Extension. Join in on Plastics on the Farm, 800-642-1234. Jim in River Falls is with us. Jim, hi. Go ahead.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having the program. So my question is, we use far too many plastics for everything, all our packaging, and not just farming, but I know, like with bale wraps and stuff like that, that there's a lot of that out there, and sometimes it's hard to get rid of it, and I know some farmers will burn it. I'm just wondering what the advantages versus disadvantages, if it's worse for these plastics to go into landfills and be broken down, or if they're burned, if that is a better way to get rid of them, or if it causes, other chemicals to be released that are actually worse for the environment.
Great question, Jim. Thank you. Burn it, bury it, send it to a landfill. Melissa?
Yeah, thanks, Jim, for calling. So it is illegal to burn plastics here in Wisconsin because burning plastics does release toxins and is, leads to poor air quality. I know that it is done just because sometimes people don't know what else to do with it. There are some landfills that accept it. Not all landfills will accept it, but some will. There is also the option to recycle the agricultural plastics just as we can recycle other types of plastics. The problem or the challenge with recycling agricultural plastics is that those films tend to be very lightweight. They clog traditional recycling machinery, and they also have an odor to them and debris from just from being on the farm. So they're not as desirable to recyclers as other types of plastics, say like a soda bottle or a milk jug, that are more durable plastics, but they can be recycled. There are some recyclers that will take them, not typically traditional recyclers, but there are agricultural plastics recyclers that will take these types of plastics.
Is there anything that farmers could do to reduce the contamination in their waste plastic so it has a better chance of being recycled?
Yeah, I mean, even something as simple as shaking off the debris can help too. And plus, you know, soil is the most valuable resource that we have for farming. And so you want to leave as much of that resource on the farm as possible. So just even shaking it off, it doesn't have to be, you know, sterile or anything like that. But shaking off the plastic and removing as much debris as possible can make it easier for that to be recycled.
How much plastic can be reused by farmers? What can you just store away and use for the next time?
Yeah, it really depends on the type of plastic. So I do know there are some produce growers that will use that mulch film from year to year. Also, greenhouses can typically reuse that plastic for a couple years. The problem is more with that bale wrap that Jim alluded to. You know, that's meant to be, I guess, a one-time use. Once it's cut off from the bale, it is very difficult to reuse that in that capacity again. Also, the silage plastic, you know, those sheets that you see, the way that silage feeding goes is that the farmer will use a little bit every day, and so it kind of chips away, and sometimes that sheet is, there's shards left instead of a large plastic sheet. And so that can't necessarily be reused for that purpose again. And so that's what we focus on when we look at recycling plastics.
When farm businesses contact you then with questions about recycling or what to do, what do they need if they do want to recycle this plastic?
Yeah, well, right now, I mean, I mentioned that there are a few recyclers that will take that plastic. It does depend on the type. So right now, there are places that will recycle the silage plastic. The bale wrap is a little bit harder right now to find a recycler for, just because it's a different type of plastic. But it depends on the plastic. If the farmer has been able to collect it and there's a lot to be recycled, that's also helpful too.
Melissa Kono is a community development educator in Clark and Trempealeau counties for UW-Madison's Division of Extension. As we look at the issue of plastics and farming, the significant waste problem that impacts soil health, join in your questions, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We look at how plastics contaminate the soil on farming fields. And according to the State Natural Resources Department, it's estimated each year around 15 to 20 pounds of plastic are used per cow. So a 300-cow dairy using plastic silage bags may produce as much as 6,000 pounds a year of waste plastic. Join in on plastic pollution and farming, 800-642-1234. Melissa Kono is here, community development educator for Clark and Trempealeau counties with UW Extension. Melissa, let's talk specifically about this partnership with Revolution Plastics. So this is a Madison-based company providing free dumpsters to dairy farms. How do farmers receive and use these dumpsters?
Yeah, so Revolution Plastics is one of the partners that I work with recycling agricultural plastics. They do have a facility in Madison and collect plastic in Wisconsin, Minnesota, some other neighboring states too. And depending on the size of the farm and how much plastic is used, they may qualify for the for a program, whether that's an on-farm dumpster that farmers can use to collect the plastic, and then Revolution comes and picks up that plastic free of charge to the farmer. Otherwise, there's also the option of recapture bags. Also, those can be for smaller producers as well within Revolution's service area, which is roughly, I think, south of Highway 8. And so farmers, if they fill five of these recapture bags, they look like giant garbage bags. And if they fill five of them, they also qualify for an on-farm pickup. And they can contact that company directly. There's also information on their website. They're just one of the recyclers I work with. What's nice is that they are located here in Wisconsin. The plastic is recycled here in the United States. It's not sent abroad for recycling, and they are a U.S.-based company as well. Other companies at times have contacted me about collecting or taking the plastic that we've collected at collection events. And one company makes composite decking out of the plastic, which is kind of neat too. And there are some plastics businesses here in Wisconsin that will take local plastic too. It just really depends on the area and that plastics company.
I wonder if it would be difficult to scale up, because a farm has to produce a lot of plastic in order to get a dumpster. Farms are spread far apart. What are the barriers to a system like that?
Yeah, when it comes down to recycling in general, it is tricky to collect that plastic and then take it somewhere for recycling. You know, anytime there's an extra step, we'll see participation drop off, and that's true with many things. But that the trick with what makes agricultural plastics tricky is that it's very bulky, so it's hard to store. Also, having it out in the elements, you know, it's designed to protect feed, but also the wind and the rain and the snow can break them down when they're outside. And again, it can be hard to store. Then you're asking, you know, someone to bring in a lot of bulky plastic. And that's, you know, difficult for people, but also recyclers tend to want to pick up a lot of plastic at one time. It makes it more economical for them to do so. So it's just a challenge with coordinating the human elements of it sometimes, and getting farmers, especially who are very busy most of the year, some times of the year, like right now, extremely busy, to be able to, you know, to participate in a program. And so sometimes they have to take care of the plastic on their own, whether, you know, that's burning or landfilling or just simply burying it on their farms.
You mentioned waste collection events, and I'm just wondering, how common are these type of events for farming, and what have you learned from doing them?
Well, so I have, with varying success, tried to incorporate agricultural plastics recycling into broader recycling events, such as the Clean Sweep program that many communities will have that collects hazardous waste. What I like about the partnership with those events is that I think it encourages more recycling and proper disposal of items overall. So whether that's pesticides or other chemicals that we see on the farm, even household waste, tires, electronics, things like that, people will tend to kind of clean up around the farm or the home and bring those items in. But the problem is that those events are expensive. They tend to be one day events. And if you can't make it, then, you know, those items, I guess, sit around until, you know, another day or another year. So it's also tricky too when, especially for smaller producers who maybe only have a little bit of plastic, in the efficiency of the clean sweep or other recycling event, I try to distribute those recapture bags ahead of time so that farmers can collect their plastic in those bags and then bring those. And again, varying levels of success with that effort.
Talking about agricultural plastics and recycling efforts with Melissa Kono, who works on ag recycling in our state. She's community development educator for Clark and Trempealeau counties with UW Extension. Join in on plastic pollution, soil health, and agriculture, 800-642-1234. Melissa, turning to solutions, how could farmers reduce their reliance on plastic altogether? What steps could they take?
Well, you know, I think one of the part of the root of the problem is that plastic and other, you know, waste materials are an externality in that, you know, the full cost of that plastic's not really being accounted for at the point of sale or at the point of use when we don't have a way to get rid of it at the end. And so while the plastic, when it's recycled in the U.S., you know, many of the plastic that's purchased is imported from other countries. And so other countries can, you know, sell plastic here at a, you know, a reduced cost than maybe a U.S.-based company might. And so, but then, you know, we're left with the cleanup bill, whether it's, you know, in our air or in our landfill, and farmers are left with this product that is tricky to recycle once it's, you know, outlived its use. And so I think one of the challenges is how do we fully account for that cost to society and, you know, to our communities and to that farmer when this product is being sold, but maybe not the full cost of disposing of it is considered.
It makes me wonder, too, what would happen if non-biodegradable plastic were made much more expensive or were banned altogether from the market. I mean, how would that change farming? What would stop that cycle?
Yeah, you know, again, plastics have improved the way that farming can be done. It has made things more convenient and safer for farmers. So I certainly wouldn't want to go away from that. There's also the option of a closed loop system where the plastics that are used are then turned into those products once again. You know, the issue with agricultural plastics is that it does have that odor. It can't always be recycled into certain other things, such as medical devices or plastics used in healthcare have to be virgin source plastics. So, but there's certainly a lot of use or a lot of other products that plastic can be recycled into. And one option could be recycle that into agricultural plastics once again. And there are companies that are looking at doing that. Revolution Plastics is one of those companies that is looking towards that as a solution. But the biodegradable plastics too, again, you alluded to, are expensive to use at this time. And so using them as, you know, a bunker cover and a silage bunker, which is a lot of plastic, I think would just be cost prohibitive until that technology catches up with the cost.
Well, let's turn then to policy. How could state policymakers create incentives for plastic alternatives? What could be done, you know, on that level?
Yeah, I do think that there certainly could be incentives to recycle the plastic. You know, there are laws prohibiting the burning of plastics. It's just very costly to reinforce those laws. And so I'm not sure that that's as much as a viable option as just incentivizing the recycling of plastics and providing a proper way for farmers and other users of plastic to properly dispose of it.
We only have a few moments left, but what conversations are you having with state agencies like the DNR to expand waste collection for farmers?
Yeah, I think that the DNR and the Department of Ag and Trade and Consumer Protection have, you know, looked at this issue. Again, as, you know, state agencies, we have to comply with the rules and regulations as they're written. And so I do think that there is some room for policy expansion with incentivizing egg plastics recycling, but also incorporating it more into recycling programs and making it easy for farmers.
Melissa, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Melissa Kono is an associate professor at UW-Madison in the Division of Extension, the community development educator for Clark and Trempealeau counties with UW Extension. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In Wisconsin's gubernatorial race, both candidates agree that more state funding needs to go to local police departments to address crime and public safety. But the style of their campaign's appeals on the issue couldn't be more different. Evan Casey reports.
You've likely seen the campaign ads by now. They're hard to miss.
We've witnessed a surge in crime, the theft, and shots fired.
Evers broke his promise. Now we're less safe than ever.
Tim Michaels will have our back.
And stand strong against violent crime.
In Wisconsin's gubernatorial race, Republican candidate Tim Michaels has blasted Democratic Governor Tony Evers for rising crime and said it would be one of his top priorities as governor. Evers has addressed the issue by pointing to spending increases he's made for local police departments across the state. No matter the candidate's approach, crime is one of the top issues that Wisconsin voters are focusing on this election. It's also a highly partisan issue. A Marquette University Law School poll found 74% of Republicans said they were concerned about crime, compared to just 38% of Democrats. Barry Burden is a political science professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He says Michael's campaign can benefit by attacking the incumbent on the issue.
As long as, you know, that is effective in reminding people about their concerns, maybe their fears about crime, it will maybe turn them against Governor Evers as they search for an alternative.
According to the State Department of Justice, violent crimes are up in recent years. Some national experts, and Evers himself, blame recent increases on the tumultuous pandemic years. But what can a governor do to address crime in a community? Kenneth Street is a law professor at UW-Madison. He says one method is a longer-term public health approach aimed at addressing the root causes of crime. Another approach? More state funding for local law enforcement.
If you were really going to have a vision as a governor, you'd say, I recognize that the local people have the best chance of understanding what kind of interventions could we do to turn it around.
Evers has said if he wins the race, he'd propose shared revenue increases for local governments. That plan includes $10 million for first responders. He's already allocated millions in federal pandemic relief funds for local police. The majority of those grants went to Milwaukee, which has seen record numbers of homicides. Michaels has also committed to increasing state spending for local police, but he hasn't said how he'd pay for it. His Back the Blueprint plan calls for more police officers in, quote, dangerous neighborhoods across the state. That's encouraging to Andrew Wagner, the president of the Milwaukee Professional Police Association. That union endorsed Michaels for governor.
He doesn't want the status quo. He wants to increase that police force and make sure that the city has what they need to be safe.
But not everyone believes more cops is the answer. Angela Lang is the director of the Milwaukee-based community activist group Black Leaders Organizing for Communities, or BLOC. She believes Michael's approach is the wrong one.
Some of the things that he supported, it feels very heavy-handed. It's very much, even if you go to his website, it's very much Back the Blue. Whereas in contrast, we see Governor Evers kind of lead with a more compassionate approach.
She wants to see more investment in public education, housing, healthcare, and mental health resources. Those are things Evers invested in with pandemic funds.
Those are what's going to help thriving communities and hopefully reduce crime as well.
Issues of crime and policing can be extremely contentious. And nowhere is that clear than in the campaign's discussion of Kenosha in 2020. After a police shooting there, the city erupted in protests and riots that turned deadly. Michaels and other prominent Republicans have made an effort to blame Evers for what they say was a lack of leadership during the crisis. Others support Evers' decision. Kyle Johnson is BLOC's political director. He lives in Kenosha, and he says Michaels is using the incident to score political points.
It's hogwash. I mean, I have stronger language that I could use, but I won't because you're on radio. But honestly, it's dishonest and it's hurting people. It's costing people their safety.
The candidates met for their only debate last Friday. Michael said if he was elected, there would be a, quote, new sheriff in town. On November 8th, the voters will decide for themselves. Evan Casey, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. And now we go inside the world of Mystery Science Theater 3000 and the Wisconsin connection to the Gizmoplex, a cult comedy TV series that has breathe new life into a 13th season. Here's a moment from Santo and the Treasure of Dracula episode. Mad scientist Kinga Forrester provides some backstory to what she calls a bright and shining beacon to the worst that cinema has to offer.
For three decades, the Forrester family experiment has resided on a number of platforms.
Comedy Central, the Sci-Fi Channel, Netflix.
But my family thought too small. Why subject our homegrown experiment to the hands of thankless executives? When we can be the thankless executives.
Join in 800-642-1234. Joel Hodgson is here, comedy writer, actor, and creator of Mystery Science Theater 3000. He's the Wisconsin connection as a proud native. Joel, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, Kate, thanks for having me.
Oh, this is going to be fun. And so just to make sure we're all starting from the same place, the show about a guy stuck in space forced to watch bad movies with his homemade robot sidekicks and, you know, riffing on these movies, snarky comments. So I'm sure you have a better elevator speech, but what is the writing process like as it's evolved over decades?
Oh, thanks. And I wanted to correct you. We also have a woman host this year. Emily Marsh is our new is one of the new hosts as well.
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah. And the writing process is pretty elaborate. Each episode has over 700 riffs in it just during the movie. Mm. So we have actually this season we have over 50 writers that have worked on the show. It's usually about 8 or 10 people per episode. And so, yeah, it's quite a challenge. It takes a few weeks and we produce actually 10 times that amount of riffs and then have to edit them, right? So we start with about 7,000 and then whittle it down to 700.
Wow. I wonder how you herd all those writers, whether it's like herding cats.
Yeah, fortunately, we have really good lead writers, people who like run the writing room, Matt McGinnis, Jonah Ray, who's one of our new hosts, people like that. So they have to be really good. And, you know, all our writers are Mystery Science Theater fans, so they know the drill. They know what to do. We're really happy and we're grateful to be doing our 13th season. The show's almost 35 years old.
How are the movies chosen?
Usually that's the process that goes to Matt McGinnis, who's our head of story. And he has to kind of go through them and find them. And then he shows them to me and I kind of do the smell test and see if they're right for MST3K.
So if the essence of your work revolves around a group of funny friends watching, you know, bad movies and making fun of them, I wonder, does that carry over into your personality and how you go about the world today? I mean, do you make fun of things in your daily life? What's the chatter like in your head?
Well, what's funny is when I have friends that go to, you know, when we go to a movie, I have friends that maybe sometimes expect me to be funny during a movie, but I really am like everybody else. I'm hoping to get caught up into the movie and get taken away with it. I only start kind of saying stuff if the movie's not that good. So I'm like everybody else. And yeah, I get pretty indulged now after doing Mystery Science Theater. So people let me prattle on about anything.
Because, I mean, you were 28 when you first created it. Can you take us back to that origin story and how about? It's really special.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, I'm from Wisconsin. I grew up in Fort Atkinson. The show that really profoundly affected me was a show, WITI, I believe. No, that's Milwaukee. Is that Madison?
No, Milwaukee, but go
Milwaukee,
ahead.
Milwaukee, WISN maybe was in Madison. Channel 3 was a show called Circus 3 with Howie Olsen and Cowboy Eddie. And he was a ventriloquist. And so it had a huge effect on me. And I got to be on the show when I was 6 years old. My mom got my sister and I tickets. And he was a ventriloquist and a dummy hosting cartoons. And I'm kind of doing the same thing. I have puppets now and we host cheesy movies. So that's where it kind of started for me. And WITI was Channel 4, and that's Albert the Alley Cat. And he used to riff on the weather. So I grew up having the Wisconsin and their puppets had a profound effect on me. But anyway, when I started Mystery Science Theater, I was in my late 20s. I had a career as a stand-up comedian and been on Letterman and Saturday Night Live and the Young Comedian Special. And so I was kind of in a position to do my own show, and that's what I chose to do.
You have twice raised millions of dollars from fans to keep Mystery Science Theater going. What about the show makes people want to give so much money and make these Kickstarters so generous?
Well, I think it's built into the history of the show. When we started, cable was really in its infancy, and you couldn't really get it everywhere. And so we had a campaign that was kind of based on Abby Hoffman's book, Steal This Book. It we called it Keep Circulating the Tapes. And at that time, you couldn't get Comedy Central everywhere. And so we encouraged people to make videotapes and send them to their friends. And they did. And so they started distributing the show for us because it couldn't be seen in all the markets. And I think because it's similar to the Grateful Dead too, where they let people record their concerts and distribute them. And so we had a similar relationship with the audience. And so when we needed them, they were there for us. And I think it's part of the nature of the show too, where there's an invitation there because you can kind of figure out how we do everything because it's a puppet show. So you can kind of figure out how you can see the seams. And so I think there's an invitation there that is pretty transparent, and our show's not expensive. You know, for example, we've twice raised $7 million to do a new season. And I think, one season is what a normal Star Trek costs, a Star Trek episode. So our shows are inexpensive too. So I think that has a lot to do with it. You get a lot for the money.
Big bang, a big gizmoplex for the buck. Mystery Science Theater 3000 creator Joel Hodgson, our guide to this cult classic, really, and the return of B-movie oddities and riffing. Join in, especially Misties, if you prefer to be called, 800-642-1234. We know you're out there. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's hear a bit of theme song to Mystery Science Theater 3000. Mad scientists taking over the world with help from bad movies, mostly from bygone eras. Here's lead mad Kinga Forrester.
I'll send them cheesy movies, the worst motion picture X. They'll have to sit and watch them all, and we'll stream them at the Gizmoplex.
Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have series creator and Wisconsin native Joel Hodgson, who stays with us, giving us an inside look at his Robot Pals world and the Gizmoplex era. Joel, take us to the Gizmoplex here, and this concept of a platform that, you know, is streaming and you can really do what you want, I would imagine. How is that working?
Oh, my goodness. Well, again, like you mentioned, we had a Kickstarter about 18 months ago. We raised almost $7 million, and that bought us a new season, season 13, and it gave us enough money to build the Gizmoplex, which is our own streaming platform. And basically, yeah, the backers were there for us, and now it's up and running. You can see it at gizmoplex.com. You can buy a day pass. You can buy a pass for a single episode, or you can get a season pass for the whole year. And that includes access to all of our episodes. There's almost 200 episodes there on the platform, as well as every 2 weeks we have a new event. For example, a week from Friday, we're premiering our first 3D episode, which is The Mask in 3D. And we distributed over 50,000 pairs of 3D glasses to our backers. And we also have them not in 3D in the Gizmoplex if you don't have the glasses. But you know how that feeling is when you watch 3D and it's never that great? Yes. It works perfect with Mystery Science.
Oh, I'm sure it does.
Hey, I wanted to say, Kate, too, yeah. You know, Felicia Day's our new MAD, and she's a New York Times bestselling author. And Patton Oswalt is her evil assistant, Max. The comedy luminary, of course.
Well,
I wanted to mention.
Give a shout out to them. And their back and forth is really fun to watch. There's a lot of chemistry there. Let's go to Phil in Madison. Phil, hi, go ahead.
Hi, thanks so much for this conversation. I just wanted to say that growing up, I did not have cable. And so whenever I would go over to my friend Chris's house, we would watch Mystery Science 3 theater, you know, at night. And it was such a treat because we just love that show so much. And the one episode that always stuck out, and I can't remember the movie, but it was an old, like, jazz band, and there was a guy that had his pants hiked up to his chest, and you broke away and started the same song, and the only lyrics you did were, hike, hike, hike your pants up. And that is the one episode that I remember to this day. And I think there's like an old YouTube clip of the show from that episode. So I still bring that up every once in a while and watch it.
Oh, Phil, thank you. Joel, go ahead with some
comments. That wasn't our show. That was a fever dream you had. No, he got it right. Absolutely. Well, I'm really glad you had a good experience with it. And that's what's funny about the show is people find it like we never. One of the secrets of our success is that we own the show. It just worked out that we weren't owned by HBO or anything like that. So it kind of has had this unique life just because we can do things like, hey, let's do a Kickstarter. Let's start up the brand again because we want to. So that's just part of the unique texture of it.
Phil, thank you. David now in Fort Atkinson. David, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was just curious. I was kind of blown away when you said it was from Fort Atkinson because I knew that the Mystery Science Theater thing started in the upper Midwest here. But I've been a Mystery Science Theater fan for, geez, longer than I really care to admit. My favorite episode among all of them, though, was a movie called Cave Dwellers, and I just thought that was hilarious. I was just curious, though, what Joel thought his best episode was, in his opinion.
Picking a favorite child.
Thanks so much. Thanks so much. You know, I was just in Fort Atkinson this weekend. I came this close to eating at the Pizza Villa, but I couldn't quite get it together. But I was in town. I was in Wisconsin for the Packer game. So I got to, I came in on Thursday, and my sister lives over in Cambridge, so really close to Fort. And so anytime I got to stay with them and got to go hang out in Fort, it was just lovely. But As far as my favorite episode that I worked on, it's real peculiar because when we make a show and we've made over 220 feature length episodes, they're they kind of blur together, and we don't know when we're making a really great one or just a marginal one because we're just trying our best, and a lot of it has to do with the movie. But I think I Accuse My Parents might be my favorite that I worked on, that I was on camera for. And now I don't really do it that much. I'm the exec producer, but in the new season, I've done a few. I'm in a couple of the new ones. So I'm on there with two of the other hosts, which are Jonah Ray and Emily.
And you've got you're doing a Demon Squad, which is that low budget horror film from 2019. What did you see in that?
Oh my goodness. Well, I don't know. You know, all these movies are, naturally we have a long list of movies that go back probably 60 years. And that one was one of our newer features. It was probably a couple of years old. So I think that had a lot to do with it. But it's just a very ambitious movie for their budget. And they really, really went for it in a big way. And it made for a really good movie. And we were really lucky when we premiered it a couple of months ago. We had the creators of that movie on. And they were big Mystery Science Theater fans. So they are really gracious and very nice to have on the show. And we need that. We need people who are making movies that are okay with us riffing on them. That's the secret of our success. They're our dancing partners.
We only have a few seconds left, unfortunately. But how do you deal with burnout, or how do you deal with rejection?
You mean rejection from other people?
Or rejection from, anything like that, because you have put together so many shows.
Oh, well, I guess it's funny because we don't really get rejected. It's more like we have this unique fan base that loves what we do. So that's not really in there. Burnout, though, is a very real thing. And we've been working so hard. Our latest season was funded during COVID and made during COVID. And that was this season 13 was the hardest season we've ever done. When we first started, we thought we'd have to send camera packages and green screens to every one of our casts and have them make it from their homes. But fortunately, the restrictions let up a little bit, and we had to have two shoots, one in LA that ran about 6 weeks and one in Philadelphia that ran about 6 weeks to capture it all. So this one was the one that almost killed us, but we're still okay.
Oh, Joel, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely.
Joel Hodgson is a comedy writer, actor, and creator of Mystery Science Theater 3000, a Wisconsin native. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.